Over the course of Adam Gopnik's quarter century of writing for The New Yorker, a couple of refrains keep popping up in his articles: France and food. In his latest book, he combines those two strands as he looks into the origin of the restaurant, the slow food movement, molecular gastronomy, wine, the meaning of taste, and he also gives us his three favorite ways to make rice pudding. The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased it has brought Adam Gopnik back to our show today. Hello.
It's wonderful to be back.
Now, you do cover a lot of big topics in this book. Did they all begin as articles for The New Yorker?
No. I didn't exactly count, Leonard, how much of this, you know, how many essays came from the magazine. But a lot of stuff in it, I think maybe the majority, is new. There's a long chapter about taste, for instance, the psychology of taste, the philosophy of taste, which actually began as a keynote I gave for the anniversary of a kind of highbrow food magazine, Gastronomica, which I adapted. And then there's a whole thread, as you know, of imaginary emails to a 19th century food writer, which I hope brings the book together.
That imaginary food writer who some people will find rather unpleasant, but you are willing to forgive her negative aspect.
Well, she's a real food writer named Elizabeth Pennell, is a figure in the end of the 19th century in England, though she actually originally came from America. There are imaginary emails in the sense that I don't think she actually received them, although who knows, right? If we're going to communicate with the dead, what better means than ethereal email?
How did you first discover her book, The Diary of a Greedy Woman?
I was doing some reporting on the recipes in the history of the recipe book, and she showed up. You know, one of the fun things, I guess, about doing this book is that we live in a time, and there's a terrific renaissance of food writing in the academy. For the first time, you have culinary history as a really serious subject. So a lot of the writing can be kind of dull, but the material is very interesting. And I stumbled upon a researcher writing about Elizabeth Pennell, this remarkable book called Diary of a Greedy Woman. She wrote 100 years ago. And I was very taken by it, in part because what was so appealing about her was that she was prepared to declare her appetite. She was sort of a Nigella Lawson of her time, and she was prepared to declare herself not a good homemaker, but a greedy woman, a sensual woman. And I thought there was something sort of funny about the idea of a woman declaring her independence from sexual roles by saying, I'm greedy, because here I am, a man at the beginning of the 21st century, in some weird way declaring independence from sexual roles by saying, I cook for my family, I take on a traditionally feminine role.
Although some of her food tastes are influenced by her feelings about other issues, her prejudices.
Yes, and as I read more and more of her work with increasing pleasure and I was corresponding with her, I did the one thing you should never do when you're researching a book. I went on reading. You should stop when you're ahead. And it turned out that not only was she an anti-Semite of a particularly kind of nasty sort, but weirdly, she had originally come from Philadelphia, which is where I originally come from. And the people she most hated in the world were the Russian Jews who had emigrated to the fruit and to the tree-named streets of Philadelphia, which is where my grandparents and great-grandparents went to. So it was highly specific and personal. She hated my family.
Was she also rebelling against the whole idea of ethnic food? Because America has embraced, at least in more recent times, Italian food, Chinese food, Mexican food. They've become a major part of our culture.
I think it was before all of that had happened.
And the hot dog, Jewish hot dog.
Exactly. I think, you know, she was pretty good about Italian food, for instance, when she came from Italy. I think, unfortunately, it was less high-minded than that and more plain bigoted. But I kept it in, Leonard. This is the point, really. Instead of trying to avoid it, I wanted to address it because it raises a central question. We all say sort of sentimentally, the table is the place where people come together. But what can't be resolved over a table? What can't manners and civility solve? It's very much, you know, what you're talking about with Thomas Frank a moment ago, in a way.
Well, you mentioned that a lot has been written about food and food tastes, and a lot of research has been done, and you deal with that as well, how important our expectations are as to the appreciation of food.
Absolutely.
This is something that people never thought about in the past.
No, absolutely. Taste is a global thing. It's a contextual thing. It's a frame phenomenon. You know, at the simplest level, you put a label on a wine bottle and says it's Chateau de North Montana, and you serve the same wine and says it's Chateau Lafite, and people taste it differently. They experience it differently.
Well, one of the things you cite, and this is something I first heard from Calvin Trillin, is that tests have been done in which people were blindfolded, given white wine and red wine. They couldn't tell the difference. And I just cannot believe that.
Hard to believe, right? And it goes, but you know what's weird about it, Leonard? It goes deeper than that. If you tell people what something is before they drink it, they will respond to it, including experts, and their MRIs you take of their brain function will be completely different. They're not lying. They're actually having a different experience.
Because their pleasure centers have already been stimulated in expectation.
Yes, exactly. And the point about that, Leonard, too, is it isn't that shows, oh, wine connoisseurs, as my daughter calls them, are frauds. Not at all. That's the way we experience the world. Everything we experience in the world, we experience it globally. You know, I have a friend who runs a wonderful restaurant, or ran one, and he always says taste begins at the door. It's your first encounter with the room determines how you'll feel about what's on your plate.
Because if you walk in and you see this as a certain kind of a friendly room, right, but very neighborhood, you're going to expect one kind of food. If it looks very formal, you're going to expect another
right.
kind of food. And if it looks like a dive, you're going to expect another kind
right.
of food.
And of course, your expectations can be surpassed, or you can be underwhelmed and all those things. But nonetheless, we experience taste always in terms of the totality of our experience, not in terms of some kind of little clue or click that's being given to our taste buds.
If you read Adam Gopnik's pieces in The New Yorker, you already know that he loves food, as we do on this show. His new book is called The Table Comes First. It's all about the meaning of food. Was food important to you, your family, when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, immensely so. I mean, important several generations. My grandfather ran a grocery store in Philadelphia, North Philadelphia. And he would show up every Sunday morning with the Jew fish spread, you know. I always remember he always would get lox and bagels and all those good things. You always get a little whitefish and sable, which nobody ate, but it was part of the spread. So it played a ritual, symbolic purpose. And then my mama is a wonderful cook, French cook, even though she's a Jewish girl from Philadelphia, because she was one of that generation of women who took on cooking as an expression of their feminism rather than as an expression of their oppression.
And that's before Julia Child supposedly turned everything around?
I think she's just contemporary with Julia Child, or a little bit younger. And so I think that she took that on. She mastered – it's funny, isn't it, Leonard? What was the title of that great book? Mastering the Art of French Cooking. You set out to master it, not to enjoy it, not to experiment with it. And she was one of those women who mastered the art.
So did you learn to cook at home?
Yeah, my mom taught me. She was a wonderful cook. And she made a point of teaching. Maybe she taught her boys. She had lots of kids, more than her girls even, for those feminist reasons. But she taught me how to make everything from beef stroganoff to a Grand Marnier souffle, and I took that into my own marriage and family life.
Well, I grew up with a mother who, like Ruth Reichels, was a lousy cook. Mm-hmm. And we were poor, so my first real experience at a decent restaurant came fairly late in my life. And when I see young people at a good restaurant, I always think, well, I envy them, and I also wonder whether they will ever truly appreciate a great meal in the way that I might, because I came to it later. Did your family go to restaurants a lot?
We did. My folks were academics, so they didn't have a whole lot of money, but we went. There was one very fancy French restaurant in Montreal where I did most of my growing up. It's called Chez Bardet, kind of old-fashioned three-star place where they lit the branches, what are they called, with the salmon and all of that stuff. Wonderful place. And I would go there on my birthday. So I certainly had some restaurant experiences.
You describe the first appearance of restaurants in Paris around the time of the French Revolution. What were they doing? I mean, there were restaurants in other parts of the world, weren't there? China had restaurants?
There was always, obviously, places where you sold food for money.
Well, you went to the inn.
Right. You went to the inn and you went to the tavern. One of my little sisters, who's an archaeologist, has discovered the world's first takeout window in ancient Sumeria. But restaurants in the sense that we mean them, right? A place where you go with a companion. A place that where you sit by yourself, you order from a menu, the kitchen is hidden, you're not getting whatever the cook has prepared that day. It's not an eating shop. And it also plays this very expanded social role in courtship, particularly. That was a French invention around 1780.
There is a theory that those dining restaurants, the fine dining restaurants, appeared in Paris after the French Revolution because people who had cooked for the aristocrats were now out of work.
Yeah, they had lost their heads and therefore their mouths to eat the food. Apparently not true. All the modern scholarship suggests that it was invented as part of that huge tumult, to use my grandfather's word, that led to the French Revolution, the democratization of taste, the transformation, people's appetites, the invention of the idea of a semi-private, semi-public institution. All of those things came together
there. And women were also accepted in these places, and that changed everything.
Right, because one of the things that the restaurant had going for it was supposed to be a healthier place to eat than the old-fashioned kind of tavern. And, of course, anything that we call health allows us to practice sex, right? That's why they call them health clubs in New York. You're allowed to get undressed if you're doing it for the good of your body rather than for its pleasures.
Where does the word restaurant come from?
It's and I should credit this to Rebecca Spang, wonderful scholar. It's a restaurant. It means a bouillon. It means a thing you – a restorative that you drink. And the drink, the healthy bouillon gave its name to the institution.
What were eating establishments in the United States like at that time? Were they just of the tavern sort?
They tended to be tavern eating club hotels. You know, one long table where everybody had similar kinds of things. You know, the great Brillat Savarin, the man who really invented food writing. And I do think it's true, Leonard, that generally speaking, to a first approximation, most of the best food writing has been done by people who didn't do it for a living, didn't do it professionally. And Brillat Savarin, who wrote The Physiology of Taste, really the kind of constitution of food writing, lived here in New York. He was a refugee from the Reign of Terror in France, came to New York, tasted all those good New World things, and then went back to France. So our imprint, the imprint of New York City, is strongly felt in the beginnings of French gastronomy.
Well, there is, I think if you ask most people, they'll tell you that real interest in food is something relatively new in this country. But then you read about the kinds of meals people had in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. So we had a food culture.
Terrifically rich one.
Was it all that different from the French food culture?
You read the great A.G. Liebling on his experiences, his dad taking him out to good places. This is a place of enormous abundance, oysters, shad roe, all those great things. Someone has proposed, Leonard, I'm not sure if I buy this or not, that Prohibition was sort of the thing that really lamed American food culture for a long time. Because you can't really separate food and wine. They come together, and once you try and make that break, it's very hard to get it back together again.
And now we have a situation where there seems to be a polarization. There are people who are very happy with fast food, and you go to any town in America and you just see a string of Applebee's and whatever. And then there are those other people who are being called foodies. Is this happening in other countries, or is this
I think it's most notable here that you sort of have two food cultures, two food civilizations almost existing simultaneously. But sure, look, it's happening in France too. You have, you know, speed rabbit pizza all over Paris now. It's bound to happen because it's part of the condition of being modern person. You have two different things, an appetite for goodness and the pressures of time.
Well, you discuss the slow food and molecular gastronomy movements in the same chapter here, even though they would strike me as being very different. What do they have in common, and should we include sustainable and locavore concepts in that discussion as well?
Well, I have a chapter about local eating because we actually spent a week just eating things that were grown or raised here in New York City in the five boroughs. The reason I put slow food and molecular cuisine, which you're quite right, seem to be radically different ways of approaching food together, is because I wanted to ask myself, why have these two things grown up at the same time? And why isn't there more of a war between them? Very few people who care about food say, I won't eat what Ferran Adria cooks or the stuff that he's influenced because I'm a slow food person. And what I finally answered, and it refers to what we were talking about a moment ago, is that the crucial ingredient is time. You know, it used to be the protein was the most expensive thing in cooking. Now time is the hardest thing to find, and both those movements demand your attention.
We're seeing a growth of vegetarianism as well. Why do you think that is?
I think that the ethical dimension of food, which is always present, but particularly becomes present when you have a lot of choices, right? When you're struggling, when you're existing on the edge of famine, the ethics of eating are to do it. I have a whole chapter about the ethics of animal eating, which I think are complicated and more complicated than people sometimes allow. You know, I have a friend in London, a wonderful cook named Fergus Henderson, who believes in whole beast eating, that you can only eat meat if you're prepared to eat the entire beast from the hooves to the nose. And that's an ethical position on being a carnivore that in a weird kind of conceptual way isn't that different from being a vegetarian.
You've included recipes here?
Well, they're not recipes of the kind you'd find in a recipe book. They're little narrative recipes, storytelling, because I wanted the book, despite its going off into some serious areas of philosophical argument, I wanted it to always be grounded and rooted in the particulars of what's on the table. So I talk about my favorite spices, cinnamon and saffron, my three ways of making rice pudding. Food is a joyful thing because it does lead us to every area of human imagination, but it also always returns us to the basics of the planet, and I wanted the book to do that too.
And for many people, food is a really important way of keeping families together, and that's something that we're seeing pushed more and more these days. In the past, a lot of people used to sit and watch television eating frozen dinners. We're now being encouraged to eat home-cooked meals.
Absolutely, and I am an evangelist for that. I think it makes all the difference. That's why the table comes first.
Adam Gopnik has been writing for The New Yorker since 1986. He's a three-time winner of the National Magazine Award for Essays and for Reviews and Criticism, and of the George Polk Award for Magazine Reporting. His latest book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food, it's published by Knopf. Thank you so much.
Wonderful to be here.